So welcome everybody. Today we will continue our presentation. So because last time we studied, last several weeks we have been studying the four noble truths. So it's this is the last of the four noble truths, and that's why. And then I have divided for the practitioner to responsible one, and do the presentations on the eight noble path. And then at the end, I will do some conclusions after this, the presentations. And I will also share some of the practice or some of the insights after the presentations. So the last week, Eloise do her presentation on right view. And today is a connection to right thinking or right thought. So today, and then Wendy will do her presentation. So please give her a hand and to encourage her and share her understanding on the right. This is the sigh of
okay.
Yeah, silent.
Okay, thank you. So my presentation is on right thinking, and I wasn't here last week to see Elvis's presentation, but Bob showed me that it went well and that she really spoke from the heart. So I'll have to see what that was like. So I'm going to start with a quote from the Buddha, and this is on the Noble Eightfold Path, and the Buddha says, "Wherever the Noble Eightfold Path is practiced, joy, peace, and insight are there." And I was really struck by this because I was thinking most people in this world, no matter what their spiritual beliefs may be, no matter what their life situation, I think we could probably agree that those would be desirable things, that most people would want joy, peace, and insight. And they would say that those are things that they want. So I thought, how interesting is that, that, you know, no matter what your spiritual beliefs are or anything like that, that's something that you would desire. And this was so important, the Eightfold Path to the Buddha, that he talked about it in his very, very first Dharma talk. He taught it for 45 years. And then, I found out today, I didn't know this, in his last Dharma talk, on his deathbed, when Subhadda, I think that's how you say it, the young man came to ask him a question, he then, his answer dealt with the Noble Eightfold Path. So obviously something very, very important in the practice of Buddhism. The other thing I was very struck by was how connected all of the eight elements are. So we're breaking them up into these presentations, but they are all so connected. And in this particular book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching, there's a really nice graph or graphic that talks about the inner being, talks about how they're all connected, the inner being of the eight elements of the path. So I just want to talk about how interconnected they all are before I start to talk about thinking. So in Sanskrit, the term for the Eightfold Path, some of these things are very hard to pronounce. Ara Astangika Marga, that would be my take on it. But in Sanskrit, that literally translates to a noble path of eight limbs. And that's one of the things that, you know, as we looked at that graphic, they're all connected. If we have, Eloise talked last week about right view. So if right view is solid in us, if we have that, then we have right thinking. So they're all connected, and if we have one, then we have another. We need right view at the foundation of our thinking. So if we don't have that, then a lot of times our thinking won't be right. If we train ourselves in right thinking, our right view will improve. So they're all, you know, interrelated. And not to say that they're easy, because they're not. And I'll talk at the end about maybe some ways that we can get to that right thinking, that right view. And then another connection is that thinking is the speech of the mind. So if we think about that, that also relates to right speech. And right thinking then makes our speech clear and beneficial. So there's all those connections between them. So at first I was thinking about them very separately and that we'd all do different presentations on them, but they're so connected. And that was what really hit me as I was doing the research. And then, this is another connection, because thinking often leads to action, right thinking is needed to take us down the path of right action. So we can see how all of those, and I bet if you think to a point in your life where you kind of lost it, all of those things kind of, you know, go hand in hand. You can see how they fall in, or not fall into place, rather. So we know that they're connected, but today I'm going to talk specifically about right thinking. And really, right thinking reflects the way that we see things. So wrong thinking, so I guess the opposite of right thinking would be wrong thinking, causes us to see in something called an upside-down way. You'd say it's a wrong perception. It's a way that's not, I don't want to say not right, but it's upside down. So using that term, I thought we could take a minute to think about, what does that mean? If our thinking is upside down, what would those thoughts look like? So let's just go ahead and list some upside down thoughts. Because if we're going to learn about right thinking, then we need to think about what's the opposite. So what would an upside down thought be? Any ideas? How about, go ahead, Gretchen.
There's one way to do it, and that's the right way.
Great.
Which is also my way.
Okay. And so we can see that this is upside down because it's not reality, right? There's definitely more than one way to do things, and none of them are necessarily, or not one of them is necessarily right. Any other thoughts that you might have on a regular basis or that you come upon that you would consider upside down thoughts or not right thoughts?
Yeah, I'm having one right now.
Okay.
John McCain's going to make a lousy president. If he gets elected.
That's true.
Did you say lousy or lovely?
Lousy.
Okay.
Okay, well, I can go one step further than that. God help us if he dies while he's in office.
Yes.
That's upside down thinking.
That's right. Fear-based thinking right there.
Wrong perceptions.
I don't know how wrong the perception is.
Are you sure?
No, I'm not sure. No, I've been working with that. Those four questions. Are you sure?
Okay. Anything else that you guys can think of? Yes, Gunda.
How about if someone is very different from me, then their problems are not a part of me.
Thank you.
I don't have any connection to them.
I have one that someone just said to me recently.
Okay.
This isn't my thought, but I think it's important. The war in the Middle East doesn't affect me in my life.
Mm. Mm. Kind of similar.
Similar to what you're saying.
Disconnection.
But this one, she was very specific about the war.
Okay. Wendy? Yes.
What about thoughts about yourself?
Good.
Like, I'm hopeless, or
yeah,
I never do anything right, or...
Good. So it can be thoughts about other people or ways to do things, but it could be thoughts about yourself, right? So that's upside down thinking because you do some things right. Right? And I think we all have that. I'm glad you brought that up, Kathy, because the other thing I want to point out is much of our thinking is unnecessary. And as I shared with you guys, I don't know when it was, but we were talking about our practice. I've struggled with anxiety in my life for a very long time, and now I have it under control, which is nice. But so many of my thoughts were unnecessary. When I think about that, like, I would worry about everything. And it was just when I think that was such an unnecessary thing. That I would worry about all these things that never came true. And it was fear-based thinking. And so a lot of times, this upside-down thinking, the other aspect of that is just our minds running all the time and these thoughts that are so unnecessary. So I thought this was interesting. I was reading, and thinking actually has two parts. And if we look at it this way, we can see how the initial thought leads us down sometimes to that road of worrying and being kind of frantic about what's going on. So the first, I'm going to write this down. Am I okay to erase this?
You can erase it and write your thoughts, you know, because...
Okay, we're ready for that. Okay. So, looking at thinking, the two parts of thinking. The first part is the initial thought. And I'm going to give an example in just a minute. And then the second is the developing thought. So the initial and the developing. And this was very helpful for me to kind of track this, making a mental notation of where my thoughts are going. So for example, okay, so today when I woke up, I knew my thought was, I'm going to present tonight at study group. That's my initial thought. I have that thought, I'm going to give a presentation. Now, there is a possibility, if I let my mind go, that that thought could develop. And I could wonder, oh, is my presentation going to be good enough? You know, when I get there, so this thought is developing, will it be adequate? Maybe I should practice a little bit more before I leave. You know, am I going to be nervous? Is Ty going to think it's okay? You know, all of these things. And so my initial thought, which was a very neutral thought, right, the fact that I have to present, as it developed, it turned into fear-based thinking. And so that was my upside-down thoughts. Because, first of all, you know, you guys have to, most of you have to get up and do this too. And so, you know, whether you judge me or not, it doesn't matter. But my mind can go there, right? And I can worry about that. So definitely upside-down thinking could occur. So the Sanskrit terms for these I thought were interesting too. I'm always intrigued by Sanskrit, although I don't know much of it. The vitarka is the original thought. That's what comes first, the vitarka. And then the vichara is the development of that original thought. And that's where I think we get into trouble, is the development. So you can see how that works. And I'm sure you guys can think of many times where you had that initial thought and then you went down that path of developing the thought. And that's what caused the anxiety, the worry, the anger, you know, whatever the case might be, the suffering. So now that we know this, that this happens in our minds, that's a good thing to be aware of it, but how do we deal with that? How do we practice in a way that this doesn't happen to us all the time? And first of all, I think we could all agree that it's not easy, right? Remember when Dr. Somaloka was here and he asked us, okay, what's the next thing you're going to think about? And nobody knew because we don't know a lot of times. But what we can do is once we have this initial thought, we don't have to go here. We don't have to go to this place where it develops and we worry and, you know, and we're anxious. So it's not easy. And we know that our mind is often thinking one thing while our body is doing something totally different and our mind and body aren't unified. So we know that this happens. So Thay Thich Nhat Hanh talks about a few things that can help, and obviously the most simple is breathing. And we know that conscious breathing helps us when we concentrate on our breathing. We bring our body and mind back together and we become whole again. So we take some time, we breathe, we're not scattered as much as we were, and we take that deep breath. So that's one thing on the very basic level, is that breathing can help us so we don't have these upside down thoughts, or rather, if we do have an upside down thought, it doesn't lead to this, which leads to suffering. And then that constant playing of the cassette player in our mind. So in Thay's book, which I'm sure most of you have read, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching, he talks about four practices that he recommends. And Elaine was actually talking about the Are You Sure? Just a little bit ago. But he talks about four practices that he recommends for right thinking. And I'll go ahead and write these down, and then we can talk about the ways that they relate to us and how we can use them. So I'm going to erase this. Is this okay? Is you guys okay with that? Okay, so the first practice that Thay Thich Nhat Hanh talks about to help us with our right thinking is the Are You Sure practice. So number one.
Are you sure?
Okay, so that question. And here's kind of an example. If I spent the morning worrying that you guys would judge my presentation and think I knew absolutely nothing about Buddhism, I would have been engaging in fear-based thinking. That's what it would have been. The more erroneous or mistaken my perception is, the more incorrect my thinking will be. So I could have done that. What Thay recommends is that we write these words on a big piece of paper so that we have this question, are you sure? And we ask ourselves this question again and again. Because if we are in tune to this, then our wrong perceptions won't cause incorrect thinking and then unnecessary suffering. So that's just something simple that we can do, asking ourselves that question. Are you sure? Are you sure that you're going to go and people are going to think that your presentation is terrible and, you know, that you don't know what you're talking about? Because then if I ask myself that question, I would think, no, you know, that's not who these people are and that's not what's going to happen. So the first practice is the Are You Sure practice. I really like how Ty puts these in very easy to understand words and relate to our life. The second is the What Am I Doing practice. And Ty tells this story that he says he sometimes asks his students, you know, what are you doing? And he knows that they're being mindful when they smile, because they're there right now, and that's kind of how he knows. So if we ask ourselves this question, what am I doing, it helps us to be right here, right now. It's almost like that little trigger that sometimes that's all we need. The bell, you know, is an example of that. But this question is something we can ask ourselves that helps us to do that. It helps us overcome the habit of wanting to complete things quickly. And I was thinking about this today when I was trying to get this presentation finished, and my sister called me. I had an opportunity to be a bodhisattva today, and she said, she has a brand new baby, a month old, and she said, I need to go to work today. They need me. There's been a crisis with a teacher, because my sister's a principal, and can you take Liam? And I was like, sure, I can come over and take Liam. But it was funny, because I was just working on like this, and thinking like, oh my gosh, I have to get my presentation done, and all this other stuff. So asking ourselves, what am I doing, helps us to overcome that habit of wanting to complete things quickly. And when we ask ourselves this question, it's not just enough to ask ourselves, we actually need to reflect on it. So, you know, if you're doing the dishes, well, yeah, but are you really there doing the dishes? Or is your mind somewhere else? So that's why we need to reflect deeply on that question. If your thoughts are carrying you away, you need mindfulness to intervene. And so that's what this can do. It can bring you back to that mindfulness. When your thinking is not carrying you away and you do things in mindfulness, then you're not going to suffer as much. You're going to be happy. And then, interestingly enough, you're going to be a resource for other people because you're present, you're there, you're able to deal with situations. So even that little thing, what am I doing, can be a good question, a good reminder. The third one, I like this, is called Hello Habit Energy. And Ty is so wonderful when he talks about habit energies that we have, or ways that we are towards ourselves, or fear that we might have in our lives, or anger, and just really embracing those things. That was always so good for me to be like, yeah, waking up and saying, I'm a little fearful today, I feel a little anxious. And I literally imagine just embracing and rocking the fear, you know, holding it and saying, I have this today, but that doesn't mean my day is, you know, terrible, or that I'm going to freak out, or whatever the case is. So we all know that we tend to stick to our habits, and I think this is particularly true with our thinking. We have this habit energy in our thoughts, and we come back to certain things. Ironically enough, we come back to even the ones that cause us to suffer. So although they might be thoughts that we know have brought us suffering in the past, we still tend to have those thoughts. And as we saw at the beginning, with everything connected, our way of acting depends on our way of thinking, and our way of thinking depends on our habit energies. So it's really good for us to be able to recognize those, because you can see the path that that can go down. And Ty says, when we recognize these habit energies, we only need to say, hello, habit energy. So not, oh my gosh, I'm anxious again. I'm terrible. I can't get over this. What's going on in my life? But instead, he just says, hello, habit energy, and talks about making friends with that habitual pattern of thinking and acting. And that was so powerful for me, because when we do that, when we're able to say, okay, it's here, I recognize it, I embrace it, then it doesn't have so much power on us. You know, if we get into that cycle of, oh my gosh, I have this thought again, oh no, you know, then it keeps going on. But if we can accept these ingrained thoughts that we have and not feel guilty about them, because I think that that guilt and shame comes up sometimes, and we think, you know, I always have this thought, I feel really bad about it, and then again we start on that pattern. So they lose much of their power. So when we are able to to say hello to them and accept them, then, you know, they're not going to be as habitual, which is good. Okay, so Ty gives us one last practice for cultivating right thinking, and that is bodhicitta, which Ty is an expert on. He wrote his thesis on it. Okay, so we know that bodhicitta is also considered the mind of love, or also known as the mind of love. It's our deep wish to cultivate understanding in ourselves in order to bring happiness to many beings. So it's just such a beautiful idea and such a beautiful practice. It's a motivating force of mindful living. So we think about it, it motivates us to live mindfully. And with bodhicitta at the foundation of our thinking, this is how it works with right thinking, everything we do or say will help others to be liberated. So if we're in that place where our thoughts are right, we don't have that upside down thinking, we don't have those unnecessary thoughts, then the people that we meet, we're able to help them. Because when we're all scattered in our own minds and we have that upside down thinking, we're not going to be a resource to others. So that's how bodhicitta can help. And then another one of the things with the connection is that right thinking also gives rise to right diligence. And so there's another, you know, another connection there. So these are the four practices that Ty says, if we do these things, it will help our right thinking. It's not easy. It's definitely something that takes time, takes practice. But, I mean, I was even thinking, like, just putting a sign on my refrigerator or something that's saying, are you sure? You know, and that for me will be a help, that constant reminder and just thinking about these things. So that is one of the things, or four of the things, rather, that we can do. Does anybody have questions? Or anything they want to share about right thinking in their lives?
Do you have any questions, Maureen?
You don't have to have questions. I'm just, if anyone does.
Cindy, she says she seemed to have questions.
I know for me, right thinking is the one, it's interesting that I actually got that one because it's the one that I struggle with the most, I would say. It is the right thinking part. So.
Why do you struggle with that one the most?
Well, I think, like I said before, I think my mind is predisposed a little bit to be anxious and to be, like, scattered and all over the place. So I have to make a conscious effort to breathe and relax and not let my mind go to this developing thought, because that's where it wants to go. You know? And I've struggled with that. It's interesting. It's not something that I was nervous as a child. I mean, my mom would tell me that, and my mother was a very nervous mother, so I'm sure some of that, you know, I was her first child. But even from when I was a child, I have this terrible story of when I was in, I think, first grade or something, I licked this whole thing around my mouth. Like, I got so nervous that I just kept licking. And it was terrible. You should see the picture. So I have this huge thing. And I just think that's been my struggle, the suffering has been, you know, in that way. And just now, I was telling you guys, like, I've been able to get off my medicine that I've been on for a while and everything else, mostly due to the practice, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, and being in a place in my life where I feel really good.
So I don't quite get number 3 and 4 because I'm new.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How does accepting and embracing the tendency to fall into the bad thinking, the upside down mm-hmm. thinking, how does that help you?
Well, and you guys can talk, I mean, help me out here. I would say just acknowledging it. First of all, when we acknowledge something, I think that's the first step. So acknowledging it, but also not being hard on ourselves, not coming from that judgmental place, rather, but just holding it and saying, you know, this is here. And if I think about it in terms of anxiety, like I said, if I wake up and I feel a little anxious, for me, it's manifest like in my stomach, and then, you know, I just feel, my stomach feels like it has butterflies and things like that. If I just say, well, I'm a little nervous today, I'm a little anxious, I can either freak out about that, or I can just sit with that, and I can feel this and say, you know, I'm going to just hold it here, and then it doesn't have as much power. It has power when I start to think, oh no, I'm anxious, what does that mean? What's happening to me? Okay, is my anxiety coming back? Oh my gosh, you know, like, if I go that way, instead of just holding it. Does anyone else have anything to say about number 3?
So happy energy is when it comes, just like mere, we call it merely recognize. Just recognize and be with it. You don't run away. Sometimes we come because whenever we have a happy energy, and when it's coming, then it's overwhelm us. Then we get sucked into that, right away. For example, if you are in a crowd or in a big group, and your friend is all there, they are drinking, right? So you have it, and then in yourself, you really have a desire to drink, and you have a habit of drinking. So if you don't really mindfulness at the moment, you just get sucked into that, and you jump in right away, right? But if you was to practice well, you say, oh, why don't I just stop a moment and see what's going on in my body, answers, right? Okay. And don't act upon it right away.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's accumulate more another habit energy. So it strengthens the habit, habitual patterns.
And Tai, can you talk a little bit more about bodhicitta? In terms of right thinking?
Bodhicitta is a big topic that I write my whole master paper on that. I have thousand things to say about bodhicitta. But bodhicitta, so you finished?
Yes, I'm done.
Okay. Thanks. So I can talk day and night with bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the genuine love, the love that without. I don't know, I spell my name wrong. How to spell genuine?
U-I-N-E.
U-I-N-E.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
N-E.
Is that
N-T,
right?
Yeah.
E. At the end. U-I-N-E. Yeah.
There you go.
So this is the practice most of the bodhisattva in Buddhism we call bodhisattva. It's a great sentient being. Great sentient being. So which is they have a great heart, so they have a lot of space to hold anything. Great sentient beings. And they have a big capacity of letting go, like great. So they have more space. You know, when things come, they receive it, embrace it, and let it go. And they have more space in the heart. So that great capacity of letting go. And they have, we have relative bodhicitta, and we have ultimate bodhicitta, you know. I have to talk, although I can talk million things on ultimate level, you know, and relative level, you know, in our everyday life, there's relative things happen, like day and night. Like conversion. So it's relative. So relative bodhicitta. So as for us, mostly we live in a relative world. So most of the things we do is relative, not ultimate. So we have to know that. But without the relative, there is no ultimate. So they have to be interconnected. They have to be interrelated. So when you have a genuine heart, it's easy to embrace everything, you know. The love that without condition, you come to me without any condition, and you go without condition. So there's no condition between you and me. But is there in that space, there is love, you know. So it's easy for communication to open up. See, when you have no condition, I have no condition, then this conversation is very natural, right? But once you set the condition, then we are got stuck, right? We are got stuck already. So sometimes I have to look at my paper and see, you know, I write in, you know, what is the definition of bodhicitta and all that in my papers. I think Cindy read it.
I'll make copies for everybody.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, like.
This will be on the website, so as soon as we're on the website, you can read it. And it's a lot of practice. So slowly I look it up and I go in detail into that, and then the practice you can practice. So you have to have the practice. So here is like, so when they talk about this, every one of us can talk about this. This is the matter of applications. How genuine are you putting this into the practice? So the more genuine of the practice, the more transformation you get. That's the practice. That's important. So So for example, when you say what I'm doing here, you have to have a space to hold that. And you have to have the ground to hold that too. So when you say that to yourself, so if when you have a habit energy, you say hello to your energy, your habit energy, and you say what I'm doing here, that means you are recognizing your habit energy. That's part of that. And in order that, you have to have a bodhicitta, my big mind. So all of this is concluding, going to this bodhicitta here. You know, that's why it's in the last here. So you have to have that in order to receive all this here. You know? In the bodhicitta, you might have some of this too, because you have the mindfulness. The mindfulness is there, the alert, the awareness is there, you know. In the relative bodhicitta, you know, you can have likes and dislike, but you still have the bodhicitta is there for you to practice.
So do people sometimes get stuck in number 1, 2, or 3 and then have a hard time getting to 4?
Yeah, even though you got a hard time, but the bodhicitta always there for you, you know, the space is there for you. But because whether we know the way to get there or not, you know. So you have to know the way to get there. You know? So if next time I can have, whenever we have, I can take a topic on bodhicitta and really lay out the practice for you. And I think this will be nice. This is the topic that I've been doing for 20 years. This is more topic here. I've been working with this for 20 years of my life. And that's why I write my paper for my MA, Buddhist study, on this one. Because this is what I practice, and this is what I contemplate every day, and look deeply into the genuine conditions of love. And just not just saying, but have to be like put into practice every day, you know. Every day you get up and you generate some kind of loving kindness to yourself, meditate to yourself. In order for you to receive something, you have to be fresh, right? In order for me to give a really fresh mind, I have to love myself in order to that. So there is many million cells in myself, and I need love too. That's a sentient being. You know, we can look deeply, because in us is like trillions of cells in us. And we have to love them too. You know? That's what our body is made up of, right? So once we able to do that, and then you're able to keep a freshly smile, a smile that can bring a lot of nourishing, a lot of encouragement, a lot of cultivations. Yeah. So in the morning, first get up and you get up slowly. You don't have to rush and get out of your bed. You know, lay on your bed. And raise that, generate that awareness to yourself. So the practice is right on your bed, you know, when you get up, open your eye, and the practice is in front of you. You know? Generate a little bit of love to yourself. And so that's where you're aware of your body, you know, because sometimes at night, our body, you sleep in a certain position, sometimes it's going to be a little bit numb, or sometimes a little bit different. But if you sit on the bed with awareness, with kind of loveness, and you get up, you really refresh yourself already at the moment. So that's the moment you already generate a bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta. Okay, and can I raise it? But I already raised it.
Thanks.
And the Buddha, I just want to add a little bit more on the right thoughts. But right thoughts can be the right intentions. So in Buddhism, we pay a lot of into our intentions, because this is where create karma comes from. If you do the acts that without intentions, karma much less. But the act that without thoughts, with thoughts and intentions, and then that's where karma create. So the Buddha say that the right thought is the thought of rise of renunciations. Renunciation of what? That's the question. Mm-hmm. Intention or thought. So renunciation of what? You have been, when you already thought, renunciation of your upside down thought, right? So for example, if you you get up in the morning, you know, and some suddenly some kind of unwholesome mental formations really generate in your thought, right? Some days like that, you know, where you get up and suddenly something is something, some seeds that arise in your consciousness surface on the, it's come up on the surface, and you have a thought of kind of angry, you know, you don't know what you're angry at. The seeds just pop up. So if you have the right thought at the moment, you're able to renounce it right away. So that is the right thought. Because you don't want to start your day without a thought of unwholesome, right? So that's the renunciations. You know, in the morning, that's the thought of desire. You desire something, kind of pleasure or something like that. If you have the right thought or right intentions, you just renounce it right away at that moment. So that is the moment of you renouncing it.
So, Tai, we think it, mm-hmm. but then, so that's that initial thought, but we don't have to let it get beyond that.
Yes.
And that's what the renunciation means?
Is yes.
Not acting upon it?
Not acting upon it. You renounce it right away at the moment.
It. Okay.
It's the moment it arises.
Okay.
So that's it after, yeah.
So, but Wendy said, it's like, you don't have to say you renounce it, but you just redirect your thoughts to something wholesome?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because, like, when Wendy was talking, and when, you know, when
Bunda
talked about, you know, and when Thich Nhat Hanh talks about habits, is that the same thing as conditioning, right?
Habit, it's conditioning.
Habit energy is conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Because I run into that all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, gets to be smaller and smaller. Little things that it's hard to notice anymore.
Condition is like initiative thought.
Yeah.
And then when we keep conditioning it, you know, like keep repeating it, and it become a habit. Mm-hmm. At first, it's not yet a habit yet,
mm-hmm.
but you keep repeating it,
mm-hmm.
and that's where it's the habit is getting strengthened. See, all the conditions put together become a habit. So, you know, so the condition is if there is the first condition, but if you are just renouncing it at that moment. That is not a habit yet because you not get familiarized yet. But if we keep repeating, so the more we keep repeating, the more conditioned we just like condition it, and then it becomes a habit. And then once it becomes, it really took so much time, so much efforts to you explain to yourself. I must say I explain a lot when I have a habit, and then try to change it. So much. Takes so much time, so much effort, so much energy to change one habit,
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of like it's coming up, it's kind of like jumping to that all the time, you know. So it's better to, you know, once the developing thought, you know, the initial thought, you have to stop right away, you know, act the right way. That's the better way to not to let it become a habit. Mm-hmm. So for example, like your first sip of drinking, it's not really a temptation. It's feel bitter, but if you keep drinking, and then that taste becomes something. When I first drink the beer, and I don't like it because it's kind of bitter.
Mm-hmm.
But if I keep drinking it the next day, and then I feel, and then I familiarize myself with that kind of taste.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one day, if I don't have that taste, and I feel something, because my body gets conditioned to it.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, I don't have that, I feel like, oh man, something's missing mm-hmm. something. The body demands that. The body demands that because you familiarize yourself into that conditions that alone. So you can have the right to taste it, but after that, you know, let it go.
Well, Tai, you know, I'm trying to think about it because the body doesn't really want it. It's like smoking. I remember when I was in college and I smoked. That first cigarette, I was sick.
Yes.
But, and the second time, I wasn't quite as sick, but I was still sick. And the third, but you know, my friends all smoked, so
mm-hmm.
I had to do what my friends were doing. Same with drinking.
Yeah.
But the body doesn't really want that stuff.
At the beginning, the body does, because the body is not conditioned at first, you see. But slowly, you force it. You put some kind of force into that, and the body adapt to that,
mm-hmm.
and slowly, and they say, and then the slowly the body like it,
and your mind likes it too. Because I was just thinking,
mm-hmm.
like over a year ago, I stopped drinking completely.
That's upside down mind.
I haven't. What's that?
You're upside down, like an upside down mic.
Yeah. And I was just thinking that for me to stop drinking, I mean, I should just have a glass of wine with dinner or something. It was more not that my body needed it. It was more like my thoughts were just like, I need to relax. And this is a ritual for myself that I do. I pamper myself by having this glass of wine. So even though, like, the body doesn't love it, it's almost like our minds, like maybe smoking, our minds like that. And they get conditioned to it.
The mind is very important. That's why sometimes the body don't like it, but the mind, because so your thoughts want it, you know? Sometimes you don't feel hungry. You got food, you're already full of food, your stomach is full of food, but your mind is tempting your mind and it's pushing you in that direction to get some more food, go to the refrigerator to look some more food. But that's why the Buddha says control the mind is very important. Mind is everything. So when you look into that, sometimes your physical body don't like to take in, but your mind really obsesses with like drinking, some other habits,
shopping,
shopping, you know,
relationships, over exercising,
so you just give a thought and then it's pulled you in that already. If you really pay attention to your body, you can see how the habits, the mind really pulling you all the into that direction. But sometimes the body really, so the body resists with the mind.
So then really the mind is what's going to pull you into
The mind is triggered. You keep some, you get some intention, you get some thoughts, and that is slowly directing your body. But sometimes the body resists, but sometimes the body wants it. There's time that the body, if the body is hungry, the body wants the food. But the body was kind of full of food already, and the body resists, but the mind still wants it.
Kind of like what I talked about too, about the body and mind aren't unified, and you know what's happening is our mind's like, oh, I need that cookie, I want that, when we're not even really hungry, and then, you know, we have to breathe or do one of those practices to get us to the point where they are unified.
And the Buddha also is talking about in this book, the first discourse of the Buddha, and they say the intention of goodwill, the intention of goodwill. And the intention of harmless is non-violence. So all these three is the antidote to something. So renunciation is antidote to desire. And goodwill is antidote to ill will. And intentions, this is antidote to harmlessness. So this is relative. You see, because this into this relative. So renunciation is antidote desire. So you renounce some bad desire, some unwanted desires. And goodwill is you have a good heart, and there is something that is wholesome and unwholesome. And this is violence, and this is non-violence. So this is an antidote. So this is what we're talking about, is a relative. We live in a world that is where it's good and bad. But later on, we go beyond this, no good, no bad, because this is, but that's really what the Buddha wants us to look at. Because all this is in energy, you know. Desire is in energy.
Excuse me. Harmlessness is the antidote to what?
To harmless? Harm or?
To harm.
Yeah. Okay. So this is all our intentions, our thoughts of what we're going to do in our life, you know. But if we live in a relative world, you know, when to there is some unwholesome desire that we want to renounce it so that we can live better, have better things. And we want to have a goodwill in our heart. And we don't want to harm anybody. You know, harming can be some kind of killings, you know, that destroy life. You know.
So this is all the thoughts that we should develop, you know, the thought of renunciation. Renunciation for monastics might be different from lay friends, you know. And so monastics is more demand for us. It's more demand too. For us, is we have to renounce sexuality. Because that is the biggest part that obstacle for making us anxious. But for lay, you know, you have family, but you have the right, you already have parents, you have a partner, you have to work with each other. And, you know, so for different kind of renunciations, different kind of level of renunciations. So for example, like the Buddha allowed lay to have family, but once you have a family, you have to have responsibility with your family, work with your partner, to sort out, you know, work together to enhance your practice, not to have an interfere, you know, have one partner for another. So there is a limit, there's some kind of limitations, some kind of regulations, some kind of training that you have to obtain, a certain renunciations. You have to have a house, you know, to host your family, but during the Buddha's time, all normal, we don't have house, we don't have, you know, we all live under the trees. Even like, stay under the tree for one night, not all over 3 nights, because of the attachment, you know, it's too comfortable, and then I go to, you know, hold this tree, you know, I just want to leave this tree, you have a very comfortable place. Because it's only one night, next night you have to go to another tree. So we have to renounce all the attachment. All the attachment. We don't have, you know, place like that.
Excuse me.
Yeah. So totally renunciation, renounce, you know. Even the rope that we have, only three. One is for cover and one for pillow, and one is to spread out and make a seat. That's three. Enough for three. Not more than three. So the total renunciation. But now I have many. So I try a little bit to go a little bit over. See. So renunciation is different. But it's more working with the mind, whether your mind really renounce or not. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you have three, but if your mind is not one more, you know, it's more now. So that's what I'm saying is that renunciation depends on the level of practice. So slowly it's outside, and then now it's going to inside, which work with your mind. Sometimes, you know, outside you think like you are renounced, but inside you're not, right? So that is not the purpose. The purpose is to renounce inside out, not outside in. Yeah. And now it's renounced. Now it's going to work with our habitual patterns, hatred. Now it's going to work with the mind. You know, the mental mentalities, mental formations. Kind of hatred, ignorance, that kind of renunciations in our mind. So it's just go slowly in deeper level. Yeah. So that's why we have renounced our desire, all the desire, not just. But there's except one, desire to be a Buddha. Okay, anybody have any question in this? So I just want to elaborate a little bit more on what's one of these. Okay, we have no more question, and we will stop here. So I will invite three sound bells so that we can conclude our Dharma discussion today. So when we all finish the eight path, I will go over all and with the summaries of the eight path.